You're listening to SBS News.
On the 6th of February 1840, representatives of the British Crown and 540 Māori rangatira signed the Treaty of Waitangi. The treaty was a bid to align the Māori people and the new colonists, the British, so that British settlement could progress unhindered. The agreement is seen by many as New Zealand's founding document. Associate Professor of Political Science at Charles Sturt University, Dominic O'Sullivan, is an expert in Indigenous policy. He says around the time the Treaty of Waitangi was signed in New Zealand, violence between British settlers and First Nations people was also at its peak in Australia, in conflicts now known as the Frontier Wars.
Colonisation was well established in Australia by 1840. There'd been a long history of massacre of Aboriginal people and really no attempt to include Indigenous people in the establishment of government or to seek any kind of accommodation.
Associate Professor O'Sullivan says the Treaty of Waitangi explains why relationships between Indigenous people and the state look very different in New Zealand and Australia today. But what exactly was the agreement? Written in both Māori and English, the Treaty of Waitangi contained three articles, considered a set of broad principles in which the Māori and British agreed to build a government. It does not form part of domestic law in New Zealand, except when it's inserted into specific legislation. Associate Professor O'Sullivan says history reveals that the agreement was formed under different understandings.
The reason there's really significant debate about the meaning of the treaty is that the English version and the Māori version use quite different language. So although the Māori text was presented to the people who signed it as a translation of the English text, in fact, it wasn't a translation. It was a different version using very different language.
In the English version of the treaty, which only 30 people signed, the Māori people cede sovereignty to the British Crown. The treaty gave the Crown rights to buy land that Māori people wished to sell, and in return guaranteed Māori people full rights of ownership of their traditional lands, forests, fisheries and possessions, and granted them rights and privileges as British subjects. In the Māori version, which around 500 people signed, the concept of sovereignty was not mentioned.
There wasn't necessarily an exact translation from the Māori language, but the concept certainly could have been explained, and it wasn't. And probably one of the main reasons it wasn't is because Māori would never have agreed to it. Wouldn't have agreed to a ceding of an absolute authority. So what was used in the treaty in place of sovereignty was government.
It's been argued that Māori people believed they remained a sovereign people, free to handle their own affairs, but who gave up governing the lands. Historian Professor Michael Belgrave was the research manager of the Waitangi Tribunal, a permanent commission established in 1975 to consider claims made by Māori relating to Crown actions that breached the Treaty of Waitangi. The Office of Treaty Settlements, established at the same time as the Tribunal, negotiates with the claimants on behalf of the Crown. Since establishment, there have been more than 2,000 claims registered, giving an indication of the level of dispute between the Māori people and the New Zealand government. Professor Belgrave says there's no evidence that Māori people were asked to give up their tribal rights or authority, or that they understood that this would happen.
Where things get a bit more vaguer is about the idea of a national society, the laws that might apply to everybody, how Europeans might be controlled. And in that area, I think there's a much greater degree of ambiguity about what happened in 1840.
Professor Belgrave says whatever the British may have intended, the treaty was eroded over time.
In 1840, I'd argue that the British government clearly was prepared to recognise that it had, in gaining sovereignty, as it believed, major obligations to ensure that Māori did not suffer as a consequence of the big plans to colonise New Zealand, which were taking place at the time. Before the end of the decade, that had been significantly compromised. You know, by then it was, well, Māori rights will be guaranteed as long as they don't get in the way of the needs of British settlers.
Associate Professor O'Sullivan explains how the British gradually overrode Maori rights.
By legislation, by military means, by control of policy systems. For example, from the very early days, the British Crown decided that it would be convenient if Maori were assimilated into white culture and effectively ceased to exist as a distinct ethnic group.
This led to countless disputes, and in the late 1960s, the Maori protest movements emerged, increasing a push to enforce the treaty. It wasn't until 2014 that the Waitangi Tribunal found it was very clear that the treaty was not a secession of Maori sovereignty.
What that means in terms of practical day-to-day politics is a matter of evolving debate and is being worked out. But it certainly lends authority to the Maori claim that the rights of government that were conferred on the British Crown don't extend to things like control over Maori children, an ability to simply go into people's homes and take kids away.
Parallel arguments are made in Australia with respect to the Stolen Generations and preventing any repeat of it. While Waitangi Day offers a moment to reflect on the extent of Maori authority over their own affairs, Associate Professor O'Sullivan says there's a difference in how Indigenous sovereignty is considered in Australia.
It's not like Australia Day where you know, the circumstances of colonisation receive quite significant public attention in, you know, in the week or so leading up to Australia Day, and then the debate goes away. It doesn't go away in quite the same way in New Zealand.
Mr. O'Sullivan says Waitangi Day often reminds Maori that the treaty hasn't come as far as they'd hoped.
Waitangi Day is, among other things, a day for reflection on progress towards honouring the treaty, rectifying its breaches, and having it influence contemporary policy and contemporary political relationships in the ways that people think it should. But that question of how it should influence modern politics, of course, as I've been saying, is the point of debate and point of contest.
Australia never signed a treaty or treaties with its Indigenous people. Co-chair of the First Peoples Assembly of Victoria, Marcus Stewart, says he's hopeful that could change soon.
Victoria are leading the journey towards treaty from a jurisdictional point of view, and we've seen other states start picking up that process, which is fantastic. Unfortunately, the South Australian government pulled the pin on it, which is devastating to traditional owners in South Australia, but we haven't seen anything yet at a national level.
The First Peoples Assembly of Victoria is a body set up to help Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people work towards a treaty. Mr. Stewart says there can't be a treaty without the truth.
For the first time in this country's history, we anticipate seeing a truth-telling process in Victoria. We hope to see that in the next, you know, 6 to 12 months, which will be phenomenal. It'll be fantastic. We've only seen 40-odd across the world, but an opportunity to really tell the true side of history, not one side.
Associate Professor O'Sullivan says Australia can learn a lot from the Waitangi Treaty in the process of creating a treaty or treaties of our own.
In the negotiating process, people have to be very clear about what they want and be very certain that the words they choose actually reflect what it is that they want.
Nadine Silva, SBS News.